Welcome to another episode of A People's Theology. I'm the host of A People's Theology, Mason Meninga. In this episode, I talk with Bruce Reyes Chow. Bruce is an ordained minister, speaker, and writer. He's also the author of the recently released book, Everything Good About God is True, Choosing Faith. You can get connected with Bruce and his work in the links in the episode description. If you're a fan of A People's Theology, the easiest way to support the podcast is if you gave it a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Tell me what you like about the podcast. Also, it would make my day if you would support my Patreon at patreon.com/Mason Meninga. There are multiple tiers with great rewards, including papers I write and even being listed as a producer. Please enjoy more inspiring and liberating theology. Today, I have Bruce Reyes Chow with me. Bruce, you are a speaker and writer on topics of faith, culture, politics, race, and technology. You're also an ordained minister in the Presbyterian Church of the USA, the Peace USA, work with some good folks in that world. But you also, in addition to all of that, recently released an incredible book called Everything Good About God is True, Choosing Faith. I'm so excited to chat about the book. But before we get into all of that, Bruce, who is Bruce Reyes Chow to Bruce Reyes Chow?
Oh, that's a good question. It's very early in California right now. So he is waking up and still has his radio voice on. So Bruce Reyes Chow, third generation Filipino Chinese, born and raised in Northern California. He, him pronouns, three kids, spouse, a couple of dogs. I do make my way in the world. I pastored for a long time, did a church plant in San Francisco. Progressive multicultural Presbyterian church plant in San Francisco. And then I work with congregations now and help them through difficult transition times. I love helping churches move through conflict well. And so that's, we call it a bridge pastor now. So I do that. And then I speak and write and give thanks every day that my wife's job gets us healthcare so I can do all these other things that feed me and hopefully
the real breadwinner.
You know, every time people are like, well, I want to do that. I'm like, well, do you have somebody that can help you with the terribleness that we don't all have healthcare? Because like if we didn't have that for my life, I would not be able to do all of these other really kind of creative things. But I managed to be able to make a way in the world through writing and speaking and trying to do good things. So here we are.
Love it. Love it. So obviously this book, Everything Good About God is True, is very much a book about for people who maybe are deconstructing or rethinking about their faith. This book is really more of kind of the constructive approach of what is it that I actually do believe? You know, a lot of us had a journey or a part of our journey where we're like, all right, I know I don't believe that and I don't believe that, but what do I actually believe? And so this book is here to help that. I'd love to, before we kind of dive into all of that, I'd love to hear just more a little bit about your own spiritual journey. Obviously, it's maybe slightly different than a lot of people that might have grown up in like conservative evangelicalism and went through the whole like deconstruction thing or whatnot. But yeah, can you talk a little bit about your own spiritual journey and how it in some ways might be similar and different from a lot of other folks who might be interested in a book like this?
Yeah. So some people, words are terrible, but you know, progressive mainline folks are going to read this book and be like, yeah, we know. I mean, it's a lot of what we have grown up. I certainly write it differently and present it differently, all those kind of things. But So I grew up in a Presbyterian, born and raised in a Presbyterian church that's historically Filipino. So it was started out of the Central Valley farm worker strikes and in Stockton, California. And we are pretty sure that at some point the denominations got together in some cafe in Stockton and divvied up all the ethnic groups, like the Methodists. Because if you look at Stockton, like the Presbyterians got the Filipinos, the Methodists got the Latina. I mean, it was very interesting. I don't know if that meeting ever happened, but it certainly feels like we were divvied up, which is fine. The Presbyterians have a long history in the Philippines. So I grew up in that, but they didn't put Filipino in its name because they knew that the part of Stockton where I grew up in was a poor part of the city, and the immigration trends were going to shift all the time. And so it is a church that is organically multi-ethnic. It was progressive before I knew what a progressive church was. We had, you know, same-sex couples in the church. It was just part of how I grew up. So I didn't know I was in a progressive church until I moved out of that space and to visit other Presbyterian spaces or other churches. And they're like, oh, you're at that progressive church. And I was like, well, I kind of just know it as church, but okay.
Yeah,
just so that, and so I grew up in that setting. I had female pastors throughout my entire time there. I mean, it was that world. And I never, you know, even in college, through high school and college, pretty regular attenders and active in youth group and did all the things. Never got involved with any of the parachurch organizations, any of that. So I've always been adjacent to friends and colleagues who have lived through kind of this more conservative, evangelical, toxic, terrible, whatever, how you want to describe that. So I never had to deconstruct to the extent that I know some folks have. I've certainly deconstruct in other ways, which I think everybody should. But mine, it's kind of, I kind of think about it as like, oh, we actually created a faith experience that we want people to experience. We can actually do that. And that's what I grew up in. And I'm super grateful for that, for those who, you know, came before me and helped to nurture that. And so that's where I come out of. I come out of just a very progressive mainline theological space that was expansive more than it was confining. And that has informed my theology and my life ever since.
You mentioned that there were some things that you kind of had to deconstruct. What were some of those things?
Yeah.
Because obviously there, you know, maybe things like hell, or obviously like LGBTQ people or women in leadership, like those are things that you didn't necessarily have to deconstruct. And
correct.
I would imagine a lot of people reading the book probably are like, wait, I had to deconstruct all of that. But what were some of the things that you did have to deconstruct, so you at least have like some sort of empathy or relationship to that deconstruction story?
Yes. You know, we were perfect, so there was not, no. So I think there are a couple things, and I they're in the book particularly. One is looking at this idea that God has a plan for our lives and trying to really think about what does that mean to think about a God who is active always. And so really looking at the idea of this quote-unquote plan is really about a collaboration between humanity and God as things are revealed, that God's in the midst of those things as things play out, so that I can fully say, sure, there's a plan, but not in the way that is often so kind of talked about so easily that we pass it on without even knowing this really terrible idea that God has everything that has happened, God has done. And I just don't believe that's true. That's one. And the second is, you know, I think this substitutionary atonement theory and this idea about, you know, there's only one understanding of how Jesus connects us to God. And that, again, is so reinforced insidiously, subconsciously. That was also, that shows up throughout all mainline churches. And I really had to kind of wrestle with, you know, substitutionary atonement theory is not the only atonement theory or the way that we are reconnected to God. And so I take that part with bigger words in the book, but to really think about the way that Jesus is our connection to God. So those two, and then I will say the funniest part is growing up in a progressive space, we didn't really talk about bodily resurrection all that much,
right?
In terms of, is it true or not? And I'm one. The spoiler in the book is that I fully believe in the bodily corporate resurrection of Jesus because I need to. Like, that kind of unimaginable event continues to give me hope about what's happening in the world today. And so, you know, those three are probably the ones where I wouldn't say that I've deconstructed to the extent that others may have to do with their faith, but certainly have had to look at these things that were passed down to me and be like, that's not where I am. I don't dismiss them completely, but here are other versions of this that I think are a little more faithful.
I would imagine you wrote this book with at least the intended audience, or at least one of the intended audiences, being a lot of people that did grow up in like conservative evangelical kind of Christianity, where they're having to deconstruct even more things than obviously you had to growing up. And I find that really interesting. So what's sort of your story and maybe connection to that type of group of people, knowing that you're likely writing to a lot of that audience, even though it's not like you're writing to your past self, right?
So it's actually, that was not my intended audience.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, because I can't write to that audience with the depth that, like, I think there are a lot of people doing that who come out of personal struggle and experience. And again, I've been alongside and adjacent, but actually, so the impetus for this book was a couple of things. One is, when we were kind of massaging this, one of my editors said, well, I don't think we can read or write another book on deconstruction. Like, we don't want to do that. So what is next? So it is a little bit of, here's one way to think if you've gone through that. But I think one of the issues that is happening right now is Christianity is so centered on evangelicalism that it begins to, I think, have an overabundance of influence on what is next. So I do say, I acknowledge it, I name it, I almost use it as a compelling reason that we need to tell our story differently and not in opposition to. So it really is a who are we, not a who we are not. So in that case, yes, I think it's going to resonate with a lot of folks who are looking for a what is next. But I don't come at it from, I just come out of like, this is a normal, regular version of the gospel. It is actually, for me, it comes out of my church planting background. So Presbyterians are not known for church planting necessarily. We've generally been allergic to it. But a few of us have also said that progressive churches, forward-thinking churches, expansive churches can grow. And I always wanted something that I could hand somebody who would say, just, I need like an overarching view of Christianity. And I would hand them something, but it always come with a disclaimer. Well, it's a little academic. Well, it's written by this person's cultural context. So, I'd have to, and this one, I wrote this because there are fewer disclaimers that people have to make. I hope it's accessible. I look at everything from what does baptism mean theologically to why the heck do people do it five different ways? I look at both, denominations, and I'm not like, denominations are dumb. Everybody should be together. I'm like, here's why denominations exist, and here's the benefits of them, but also here's the trouble we get into. So try to answer all the questions that I planted for about 15 years that everybody would ask me about faith. Like the hardcore, like, okay, tell me about, so why do we, this is communion thing. Like, it feels like, what is this? Is Jesus really here? Like, what's going on? Right. So I try to get at, in 40,000 words, like higher level, here's why we do these, and then actually practical, here's how it plays out in our lives and the world. So what I hope it does is it gives people something to hold on to as they're coming out of whatever. I would hate to ever say that I tried to write a book for all people, but this, I think, comes close. Hopefully it touches upon folks who have been in the faith for a while and just need a refresher, or like, I actually don't know about that. I'd love to read something, but I can't ask because I've been in the church for so long. This might be okay, right? As well as the people who are brand new. So
it does feel a little part mini systematic theology and also kind of mini catechism even. You really are like teaching people about like theology, church history, worship, all these different things, all aspects of the church and Christianity.
And questions at the end, like, it's not a curriculum. So any curriculum people out there, don't at me, because it's not at all like meant to be anything. But part of it is like, well, what are the two questions I hope people ask as an individual in a group at the end of this that might be helpful as they're forming their own? It's based off of a faith statement that I had written, years ago and have been massaging over time. And that's how it's kind of formed, and that's the shape it takes. So it is, it's totally a systematics book, except obviously we don't call it that. But yes, right. That is, very much so.
So obviously the intended audience isn't necessarily like people who are deconstructing, but obviously, like, I would imagine most of my listeners have some sort of connection to that kind of story. And I think it's important for people who are deconstructing to have a time in which they deconstruct the bad ideas that they grew up with and inherited, right? And I think that's a necessary part of that deconstruction journey. But as the sort of the point of the book is, what is it that you actually believe? And maybe here's some helpful ways to believe about Christianity, God, Jesus, etc. And so kind of beyond the specific questions around, like, this is what you should believe about Christianity, why is it that you think that it might not be necessarily super helpful for people to stay in that space of, I just am deconstructing the bad ideas and not actually constructing the beliefs that they may actually have?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm kind of the stay in that space as long as you need to, because, you know, I think all of us are needing to deconstruct different levels of different things and would hate to kind of prescribe a timeline for anyone. But I just feel like faith in opposition is not sustainable over the long haul. I mean, as a church planter, I get a lot of this out of, like, meeting people in California. We actually had people who were completely unchurched. Like, actually, it wasn't just a matter of we had a bad church experience, but out on the West Coast, like, folks actually grew up and never went to church. Right. So when they were coming to us, they were actually looking for, in, like, I'm in a Christian space now, I better hear about, you know,
Christianity.
Like, I'm not going to out spiritualize San Francisco. Like, my lane is here, and we're going to talk about this at this point. And so what I did notice for other church planters that were starting, a lot of them started because they didn't want to be something else. They were started out of either a church split, or they were, and I'm talking about progressive spaces and even, I guess, conservative spaces, because they were formed in opposition. And when that opposition loses its steam or it no longer feeds, like, what's left? And so the joy about the place that I was at, we were intentionally about who are we, not who are we not. And that created a more sustained, life-giving, and it felt less adversarial in a way that drew energy away. It didn't mean we didn't challenge things that were out there, but it came from first a base of who we are, then tells us what we're opposition to, rather than what are we opposition to, and then that forms who we are. I just found that knowing who you are first is a much more life-giving, sustainable way to approach faith. And that's really where I'm hoping this book helps to get folks, is that, yeah, you're never going to lose those places that, you know, have left these marks on your life, but we can't let those define you, center so much that it defines the very nature of your faith. Again, those are always going to be with you, but there's something more if you think about, gosh, who can we be? What does it mean to be expansive in our theology and not constricting? And, you know, I think those are liberating for the soul.
Yeah, I remember when I first started having those kind of doubts about my faith and started deconstructing. And obviously, again, I was in that place of rejecting these certain ideas. But then it wasn't really, I mean, I guess I had encountered people like Brian McLaren and Nadia Boltz-Weber, you know the names. And they were certainly helpful for me to construct a better kind of Christianity. But it really wasn't until I went to seminary and started learning about, like, process theology and liberation theology and all these other kinds of theologies where I'm like, wait, that's actually what I believe. And that was really helpful for me to then start actually constructing what I actually do believe. And obviously I'm very much in the Christian space doing all of that. And also I know people that deconstruct and then they find themselves outside of Christianity, constructing beliefs outside of Christianity. Maybe they go to Buddhism or Judaism or wherever it might be, right? But they actually start constructing. And so one of the things that I always encourage people is, you know, take the necessary time that you need in order to reject the beliefs, the bad beliefs. But whether it's in Christianity or not, I happen to be somebody who really encourages it to be in Christianity. But if it's not, go find a place for you to actually construct the things that you do believe in the world, whether it's political beliefs, ethical beliefs, theological beliefs, personal beliefs, whatever it might be. Construct those things. I think it's a helpful space to be in after you've taken that necessary time to reject the bad beliefs.
Yeah. And folks who come out of that more conservative evangelical space, like what you just said, right, is like world rocking. You mean,
right,
it's okay for me to think outside Christianity? Whereas I grew up with that, right? So I talk about that in the book a little bit. I was like, just to be clear, if you're reading this, Jesus is not the only way to connect to the holy and the divine. And so, you know, making sure that, like, so there is like a little whisper and nod to that group as I go through that. I speak of this as if this is normal, and I think I'm trying to normalize these things, but knowing that there may be a few places that I might be like, what did that, what? And trying to kind of reinforce this idea. No. It's okay. It's okay. That these are beliefs that Christians have held for a long time. So it's not as if I'm not coming up with anything new, but maybe telling the story a little bit differently, and hopefully, right, in a way that folks can hear a little bit differently, yeah, now.
Well, I definitely actually want to talk a little bit later on about the historical diversity of Christianity and the fact that, yeah, you really aren't saying anything new, yeah, but important nonetheless. This episode of A People's Theology is brought to you by United Theological Seminary of the Twin Cities. Are you considering exploring your faith more deeply, or are you called to ministry but haven't found a seminary that is quite right for you? When you come to United, you join a community that is intentionally open, socially aware, and theologically adventurous. United's passion is equipping leaders to make real, lasting change in the world through their many different degree programs. Whether your vocation is in faith leadership, nonprofit leadership, academia, the arts, activism, or social entrepreneurship. And the best news is you don't have to uproot your life to attend seminary. United offers maximum flexibility to fit your schedule. Attend on campus or online, part-time or full-time. Their leading distance learning technology allows students to be active in the classroom and engaged with the United community. Want to learn more? Visit unitedseminary.edu/apeoplestheology or click the link in the episode description and receive a $1,000 scholarship when you apply and are admitted. United Theological Seminary of the Twin Cities, training leaders to dismantle systems of oppression, care for the spiritual needs of a multi-faith world, and push the boundaries of theology. I want to hear a little bit more about your ideas of God. Obviously, you're kind of taking all these different types of theological topics and providing different ways that Christians have believed about these things and what you personally believe. One of the ideas that I often hear from people that deconstruct is their idea of God. That, you know, that's one of the things that often is deconstructed. You know, a lot of those of us who grew up in conservative evangelicalism think of God as kind of this like guy in the sky that is like controlling everything and is both wrathful and merciful. But can you talk about your idea of God that you want to construct and propose, that might be a way better idea of God?
Yeah. Gosh, I remember it's so easy to be smug as a mainline person. I tell you, sometimes we like, oh my gosh, do people really think that? And then, you know, you hear about the pain and trauma that has caused people around their faith and their life and how they live in the world. And it makes me sad. So again, you'll hear whispers of nodding to that experience that I don't think God is this, you know, chess playing, you know, grandmaster sitting up there moving us around, but that God is one who co-collaborates with us, and that there are things that, and not everything that happens, state this very clearly. Actually, my editor had to say, you need to stop saying the same phrase over and over again. It was basically something along the lines of, God does not control everything. Like, God does not make every piece move, you know. And, you know, because I think I tell a couple of stories about, you know, in times of trauma, people for some reason feel like they can say, well, it's part of God's plan, or, you know, those kinds of things. And I have had trauma in my life. I remember my brother-in-law being shot and killed, and somebody saying, well, that's somehow part of God's plan. We just don't understand. I'm like, well, that's bull. Not the God that I believe in doesn't say that this is part of a plan. Some things just crappy happen in the world, and that's one of them. And God's plan now is, how do we work with God as this moves forward? So I'm about a God in that regard who is with us in all that happens. So God is always present. And our role is to figure out, what are God's intentions and hopes for us as our lives are revealed and as our lives move forward? And that's where this plan piece comes more into play, is God has intentions and hopes. We don't always know what they are, but our our role is to figure out what those might be, and we hope they align with those hopes and intentions more often than not. So mm-hmm. I have a God that works with us and walks alongside in whatever language we want to use for that. I believe in a God that's expansive. Again, this idea that God only speaks to humanity through Jesus, I just simply don't believe. Now, that's how God speaks to me, and I'm clearly in Christian spaces, and I love when people experience God through this person known as Jesus and teaching and death and resurrection. But, you know, I think of a God as much bigger than that. I think of a God that weeps and a God that changes. The perfect God is a God that changes and adapts. I think that, you know, there's just so much more companionship with the God that I believe in. Yeah. I mean, I hope that's helpful. I mean, those are some of the things about God that I believe in.
So if it sounds very processy, your understanding of God to me, and
I'm Presbyterian.
That's right. Any one of my listeners would know that it's going to be just a very processy kind of podcast. So it's no surprise that this is kind of a processy understanding of God. Yeah. It is interesting, though, that obviously the Presbyterian tradition comes out of the Reformed tradition. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting knowing how different Reformed doctrine of God is from a more process understanding. I'm curious maybe how you sort of navigate knowing that there probably are people within your tradition that think about God very, very differently since they come from more of a Reformed understanding, whereas you've got a little bit more of this processy understanding of God.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, I think there is, because I think what's happened, honestly, is that we've just gotten lazy about how we talk about God. That I think I think a lot of folks will, you know, God is omnipotent and all knowing. I'm like, okay, fine. I grew up with that language. Well, what does that mean? Mm. Right? I mean, it's easy. I mean, this is where I think we do most of our damage in our hymns, right? We have all these hymns that we sing, these phrases and ideas, but we never take them down to the street level and like, well, what does this actually mean then for me in times of whatever? So I actually think, I think the people that are going to be upset with anything I say are mostly going to react out of, I think, a position about God and faith that is now forcing them to really think about what theirs means. Mm. And so if I actually believe in an all-powerful, omnipotent God, well, what does that even mean? Like, if I believe in this, now I actually, and this is where I think the church has failed oftentimes, is that we have not given people enough to actually hold on to in real life. We have too many kind of great theological things that we say, and then we don't give people the, so what does this mean? And mm-hmm. I think that that's where it's probably going to be more, people are going to be more challenged with this. I don't actually think, again, most mainline people right now, this is kind of where a lot of us are. Like, again, right. My folks are not gonna, for the most part, people are gonna be like, yeah, we've been teaching, this is kind of where I am. If you really pressed me on what I think about Jesus and what I think about, yeah, that's probably where I'm too. But I've never had permission to say it. This is institutional inertia or cultural kind of pressures that if you push on that and any of these things, then somehow, you know, you're risking something. And I just don't think that's true. And in mm-hmm. fact, people I think are yearning for kind of more like, what does this actually mean? And that's where it comes from. So I don't know if there are specific things that you want, like you want me to press into, but I kind of feel like I'm not stepping outside many of the things that a lot of mainliners already believe right now.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It does seem maybe 100 years ago, the difference between the average Presbyterian a person in their theology versus the average Methodist person in their theology might have been much greater than it is now.
Right. Oh yeah.
In those ways, it kind of feels like what's sort of the point of these different traditions. And I love each of these.
It's all governance. At this point, it's all governance. It's like, right. how do we decide we're going to make our decisions and which one do you like or not like? And,
right. Right.
And ultimately, I mean, there may be a few things, you know, the iota in Homo Eusius and Homo Eusius from the Lutherans and where is Jesus in communion. But, you right. know, do the person coming into the church for the first time care about that?
Literally do not care whatsoever, right?
Exactly. It's like, you could fight wars over it if you want, but.
Totally.
So, yeah.
It's interesting that you think in a lot of ways, a lot of the maybe average church person that you have worked with probably thinks about God in these ways, because I often think, or at least the people that I interact with, that especially grew up in the more conservative evangelical world, when they start deconstructing their ideas about God, one of the things I often hear about, especially when I start talking about process theology, is, oh, wait, that's like actually what I want to believe about God. Or that's what I've felt to be true for a while, and I didn't know that there was actually like a theological system that thought about God this way. And so it's interesting that it seems like a lot of mainliners might be sort of in that space, but they may or may not know or be aware of process theology. And certainly that's the case for deconstructing evangelical people. And so I just think there's just so much potential for, especially in America, there's so much potential for this better understanding of God, or at least what I think to be a better understanding of God that happens to be, I think, pretty aligned with process thought.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, the biggest frustration I have right now in the United States in particular is that people have not been given the permission or the platform. I don't know why we haven't been able to speak about this, I think, very normalized understanding of who God is. But the biggest frustration is we've abdicated a national voice around this. I mean, the book starts with a little bit of taking us back we write it in the first, like if you're there during the insurrection and some other stuff and all these things are going on, you know, I think the quote is, it's time for us to speak the hell up or something like that. But it frustrates me so much that this is not a radical way of thinking, but one that a lot of folks have just unleashed and, you know, figured out how to work together. That is just as valid of a Christian voice and message that is really not out there. And we've abdicated the Christian space to, you know, conservative, evangelical, nationalist, whatever, how we want to describe it these days, that's when you talk about Christianity, that's where people go. And I want us, you know, who are kind of thinking in this different way, to have a seat at that table, at least to folks like, well, yes, but there's also this, and it have it become more to mind than us having to fight for that space that I think we've given up. So I think this is not, again, it's not radical, it's not particularly, it's not new, but I do think that folks have forgotten how to tell this story. And I hope what this book does is says, okay, how do you tell it? Because if you can't tell it, and you don't know it, then, you know, if you don't know it, you're not gonna be able to tell it. So here's some promptings for you to begin to think about this and articulate it. And so hopefully we can build something greater so we're just as valuable and vital of a voice as some of the other versions that are out there.
You know what, that I think that will take, that work of kind of maybe fighting back for the space that is necessary of the kind of Christianity that we want to make in the world. I think what needs to be deconstructed in a way is, especially in the mainline world, is a deconstruction of their notion of evangelism.
Yeah.
And especially in the mainline world, there is I would imagine for a lot of ex-evangelical people, there's a lot of concern and suspicion and skepticism about evangelism. And rightfully so. There are really good reasons for that. And at the same time, if we think that we have this way better understanding of the gospel or of Christianity, we need to be sharing that with other people. And that's part of the reason why I've, you know, created a podcast and I've got a YouTube channel and I tweet all the time, is because I'm like, there's this better kind of Christianity out there and I want other people to be a part of it.
Preaching to the choir, my friend.
Right. And it's so frustrating when I see institutions that have a lot of money, like a lot of mainline institutions, be so unwilling to empower leaders that want to do that great work of actually evangelizing the kind of Christianity that's actually great.
You have been speaking my word for the last 20 years in this denomination. Because you are absolutely right. There's a preacher joke that's like, what's the greatest contribution Presbyterians have made to evangelism? And it's restraint. So, that has been a huge frustration for many of us. But I will say, one of the things I write about is, I'm not here to salvage the word evangelism, but I am here to challenge us to engage in that work. Call it what you want, but if you are not out there sharing the story, then we have just as much, we are complicit in what is going on.
Oh, yes.
You know, I think you're right. People have this, it's as if the only way you can evangelize, again, they can use whatever language they want, is this way. And I'm like, that is lazy and untrue. And in fact, you know, I'll tell the story about, I've never actually talked with somebody about faith, and I'm a pastor, and had a negative reaction to me, other than conservatives who don't like what I think theologically. But everybody, because I'm like, I'm not going into the coffee shop cold to random person and asking them if Jesus Christ is their Lord and Savior, which is the stereotype of what we don't want to be. And I'm like, one, I don't know how many people do that. But also, is that, I always say, is that how you would talk about church? Or would, is it a matter of you're in relationship with people already and you happen to talk about your faith? I can guarantee you that either they're going to be like, oh, that's great, and move on, or they're going to be like, huh, you're part of church? Tell me about it. And I just feel like we have this this aversion that is unjustified to sharing our faith. And I think some of it is because we don't know how to articulate it. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm hoping this book helps people to do.
Yes.
Is to like, okay, so maybe the reason I don't want to is because I actually don't know what I believe beyond these slogans of mainline Christianity. I actually need to know a little bit deeper about what those actually mean. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that this gives a little more permission to do so. We could do a whole series on why mainlines are terrible at evangelism.
I would imagine so. One of the other things I love about your book is you really dive into ideas around sin. And again, obviously that can be a little bit of a trigger word for a lot of people who grew up, especially in the world that I did, of conservative evangelicalism. But I think having a robust view of sin is actually one of the most important constructive theological beliefs that we should have. And so I'm curious, like, what your understanding of sin is and why you think that understanding is still important to have and not actually just rejecting the notion of sin altogether.
Yeah. Well, if any of the Presbyterians out there are mad at me about not being Calvinist enough, that is certainly where my... I did not put worms of the earth in, which is Calvin's one of his things. But and it was interesting as I was writing this, and I did the version of where I would write and then send it in and write and send it in and not do the all at once. And around the sin stuff, that was probably the one place where I had to be reminded about how some might read sin, especially those who come out of a much more, like in my tradition, we don't talk about it enough. And so you know, I think my editors felt like maybe it was overcompensating for that, and it might come off with other people as like, "Wow, you just hit really hard on this." But so for me though, the nuance of how I approach sin is both personal and institutional and systematic and communal. So as you read, when I talk about sin, it isn't just a personal, "Here's how terrible you are," but how you've broken this covenant with God. It really is this, how have we as individuals, institutions, and systems, how have we turned away from God's intentions for humanity? And that really, so that it is not an accusatorial way of thinking about sin, but it's one that just embraces the realities of most of the things that we understand to be true, that, you know, around race and gender and sexuality and economics and incarceration, just all of these ways, systems and individuals who have helped to create and reinforce them, how we've all participated in that. And so the lamenting of that, the acknowledgement of that, and then how do we move into the forgiveness and healing from that? So I do hit it heavy. We actually shortened the sin chapter down quite a bit because it felt it took a little too much. But I really wanted to reinforce this nuance of individual systems, institutions, so that it wasn't that just you're terrible kind of version, but it was that, you know, together we fall short of what God hopes and intends. Now we got to figure out, what does God hope and intend for us to do and be? Mm-hmm. And that's where I hope we move into kind of a much more engaging, enlightening kind of rejuvenating space around our faith. So it's a turning away from who God intends and wants humanity to be, and a returning towards God's intentions is kind of how I look at it.
Yeah, thinking about sin in these ways around like systematic injustice, it's even like non-Christian people talking about you know, injustice, like systemic injustice. It's like the way that they talk about that is not all that different than the doctrine of total depravity, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Which I think is the irony of all of that is, you know, we get a lot of, especially in the mainline world, you get a lot of people who would totally believe sin as like systemic injustice, but they would never want to articulate it as like total depravity. But it's like, that's pretty much what you're articulating, is that we can't help but be complicit in these systemic injustices. And even at our best, we still are falling short. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that's exactly what total depravity is, really.
I mean, I think that's part of, like, I certainly don't go into original sin. I don't touch on, I mean, I don't really believe in that. But it's this idea that, yeah, without even knowing it, we participate in things that create harm in others. And I mean, I think it's woven throughout the book, this connection to one another, this both, and I grew up in a tradition, right, where communal relationship with Jesus Christ, we got totally, but personal relationship, not so mm-hmm. much. And then you have others that it's all personal and no communal.
Right.
And I'm like, you can't do one without the other. Mm-hmm. And so there is, I hope, even through the sin part and all throughout, there is this woven kind of both and that makes more sense. I mean, yeah, but it just makes more sense and makes us more feel more whole. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, there you go.
What's up, a People's Theology listeners? I would love for you to support the podcast. There are a few ways you can do that. First, sharing the podcast to others who you think would also enjoy it and find it helpful is a great way to support the podcast. It's like evangelism, but for something actually good. I really think the ideas explored on this podcast matter, and I believe they are worth sharing with others. Second, if you're not totally depraved and use Apple Podcasts like me, please give the podcast a 5-star rating and review. It might not seem like much, but every rating and review helps the podcast tremendously in a world more predestined by algorithms than by God. Third, please support my Patreon at patreon.com/Mason Menega. It's like tithing, but for something actually good. This podcast takes a lot of time and energy to make, so supporting my work through Patreon is a great way to make sure this podcast can continue to be made. With all that said, please enjoy more inspiring and liberating theology. At the beginning, you kind of mentioned just really briefly that you believe in a bodily resurrection. And mm-hmm. obviously, maybe for some people who grew up evangelical, that was obviously a very big piece to their Christian belief system. And whether they may or may not believe that now, I'm really curious just your thoughts around why the bodily resurrection is important for you. And I'm really curious around that.
Yeah, I think the line in the book is spoiler alert, or didn't expect that, did you? Yeah, you know, this is one of those that I've been around colleagues who, like, well, we believe in the spiritual resurrection. Brian McLaren says something like, it doesn't matter if it's happened or not, I believe it to be true. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I mean, I love Brian, but it was like, well, that's interesting. I actually believe it to be true. Like, even, and I believe in that it happened. And, you know, I grew up, one of my early mentors said basically to me, what happens if it actually happened? We don't try to explain it away. Because oftentimes we would try to explain away what might have happened, why people experienced the idea that Jesus was come back to life. Maybe he wasn't fully dead. Maybe there was something that he was given that only pretend, I mean, all these. And I'm like, well, what if we just went with, something happened beyond our imagination, beyond our scientific intellectual understanding, beyond even our gut reaction of what could happen in the world, and that actually happened. Huh. I mean, for me, that's a God that I'm like, huh, okay. So when I look out into the world, I can look at all the terrible things that are happening in local community, globally, and believe that there is hope beyond anything intellectual, imaginative I can think of, or humanity mm-hmm. collectively could. And so it is, I mean, for me, it's the ultimate choosing of a faith in something that makes absolutely no sense. And so that's just where I landed. I can't prove to anybody why that version is better than trying to figure out what may have happened scientifically, but that's where I am. And it's a version that I fall back to when I get into my worst. I'm like, oh, this just can't get, this is, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm like, well, in God, all things are possible. And I do think at a core level, I have to trust in that. That's what gives me hope for the world. And at my deepest struggles, like, okay, I can do work. I can participate in the revealing, but at the end of the day, God can do amazing things. And, you know, and like that's the title is not a mistake, right? I mean, this is a choice to believe in that. I'm not going to be able to prove it to anybody. I'm not trying to, but here's where I am, and here's why I've chosen to believe it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I probably am closer to that Brian McLaren camp where, let's say, on the inverse of what you were just proposing, if for whatever reason we were able to prove that it was false, I still would believe in resurrection.
Right.
Like for me, resurrection, you know, specifically Jesus' story is, here is this man who is killed by an empire, and he comes back to life. And to me, the whole point of resurrection then is that state or imperial violence does not have the final say.
Right. Sure.
And I believe that to be true. And I hope that to be true, not just for Jesus. I hope Jesus's resurrection is not the exemption to resurrection. I hope it's the exemplification of what could happen to all people that are experiencing violence from an empire, and that violence is not going to have the final say. And so I hope that to be true, whether or not that bodily resurrection actually happened or not. I don't know. Maybe not.
Right? Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're not the first one. I'm sure. You better get, if you're here to accuse me as a heretic, better get in line.
Exactly. No, I know. I'm like, I have to keep warning my family and parents, like, okay, it may start again. Like whenever something comes out, it's like, okay, here's what an apostate is. When people start calling me that, just so you know, it's fine. Don't respond, Mom. It'll be good. I had to, actually early on when I was a little more in public stuff, my mom would respond to stuff online. I'm like, Mom, you can't.
It's just gonna end bad.
It's just gonna make you sad. You should either just turn it off or whatever. So
the last thing you want is your mom to get in the middle of when bullies are trying to fight you.
I know
that was like the worst thing that could happen at like school, if you're getting bullied at school and then your mom comes in. Yeah, that's like and so you don't even want that to happen on Facebook.
Though my mom, not at my high school, but for my younger sister's high school, my mom was the truancy and drug prevention person.
The bullies don't want your mom to show up then.
Yeah, how could you imagine? My sister is always like, yeah, it was great. My mom kept getting my friends like driving around the truancy truck around the city and picking up my sister's friends. So yeah. My mom loves that space. So I really did have to be like, Mom, these are not people you need to engage with. It's fine. They'll be okay anyway.
So one of the things I love about your book, and it's coming up a lot in this conversation, is that many of the theological beliefs you talk about and propose are actually pretty historical. Like you mentioned before, nothing of what you're saying is anything new.
Yeah.
And I think evangelicalism especially has done an incredible job of shielding people away from actually learning about the diversity of theological beliefs in the Christian tradition. And evangelicalism has done an even better job of not just shielding people from that, but thinking that evangelicalism is the only way to think about theology. And so I'm curious, like, how you think through kind of that dynamic of knowing that evangelicalism has done that and knowing that there's so much diversity of theological belief in the Christian tradition, and that what you're saying is not really all that new.
Yeah. I hope I write it as that's just normal. You should have to discern what you believe out of a lot of options. And so it's actually a real gift to be able to see multiple ways of the same event or multiple views of this thing. And I'm giving you one way to think about it, or giving you a way to think about it in multitudes. But the one way is to embrace options. Like, it's okay. Like that. The phrase I hate the most is, when your mind's so open, when your mind is so open, your brain falls out. I can't remember what it is, but people throwing that at me. And I'm like, actually, when your mind is open, man, the expansiveness of the world and how you experience God is that much greater. Like, that's what I think. And I just feel like when we normalize this idea that options aren't bad or other views aren't bad, like I'm very clear that conservative evangelical space, you'll never hear me say that they're not Christian or that whatever. But I will say I think our version is better. I have no problem saying that. But that is an option for people. When I was church planting and people came in and we were way too progressive, I'm like, you know what? I don't want you to come here and be stressed every Sunday. Like, that's not my, if there's a space that you're going to be fed more, that's where you should go. I don't have any problem with you going there. Here's why we're not that. But, you know, so I've always felt like the more options, the more you get to actually eventually land in the spaces that you're supposed to be at a particular time. And you may shift again, right? I just feel like this idea that there is one way and the only way, and it's only for, and it's always now this way, is so confining that eventually people realize that we change and we shift and we need different options and ways to think about the world because our lives change. And mm-hmm. I'm just hoping to normalize that around faith. Mm-hmm. So I just, that's just, again, always how I've grown up. My church is always about, well, you know, if people had different ideas about things, they brought them in. We disagreed, certainly. And eventually, you know, disagree great with a few things, but you know, it was always normal that you should be able to think lots of things and it'll be mm-hmm. okay. God's mm-hmm. God,
and that you can change, you have the permission
and you
to
can change.
Change.
Yeah. And God amazingly can hold all that. Mm-hmm. We'll be fine. God will be mm-hmm. fine.
The other thing about it is it's just simply ignorant of church history to think that Christianity has been a monolith, right? I mean, yeah. even at the very beginning, you get the disciples of Jesus not agreeing with each other about who Jesus is. And then certainly that gets picked up in the early church where there's all these disagreements. And then eventually you get Constantine involved and he's like, all right, we got to get this thing figured out. So you start getting creeds developed, right? But even in the midst of that, we still get schisms and then eventually get the Protestant Reformation. And then that really opens the Pandora's box for diversity. So there just has always been that case in Christian history of diversity of theological beliefs. And it's ignorant to believe that that's not the case.
Well, and I think some folks would see that as doubting something like what, like you, like, so why, like, I see all those things as part of a process for us to grow closer to maybe what God intends us to be. And maybe it's a variety of things. But I think other folks are like, oh, it's just too much. We need to land on one thing. And that's what I get to hold on. And I was mm-hmm. like, you just can't hold on to that long. I mean, it's eventually going to no longer feed your soul. And it doesn't make it bad that it doesn't. It just makes it you've mm-hmm. moved into something else. And if we never give people options, depending on their life and what's going on, then, you know, we're doing them a disservice. But oh, my goodness.
Mm-hmm. Wild. This might be kind of the gospel question for you.
Okay, uh-oh.
What would you say Christianity can still offer people, maybe lifelong mainliners or people who are deconstructing? Obviously, you still think that Christianity has something to offer the world. So what is it that you think Christianity can offer the world?
Hope. I mean, ultimately, it comes down to hope that exists already, right? The things that have been realized. You know, I am one that believes that if the church has not been doing the good work that it's been doing, things would be a lot worse, which feels strange to say. Mm-hmm. But I want to acknowledge, like, when folks say to me, like, it's so terrible now, it's awful, I'm like, you know, you're almost dishonoring my ancestors who fought so hard for so many things. And, like, so there's hope that's been realized. I'm like, no, let's look. Like, it could be worse. Like, it could be. Mm-hmm. But also hope that things could get better. And our response to that hope is to try to participate in that realization. Mm-hmm. And I think that's energizing. I just feel like that goes like, okay, I can get up in the morning and I can do that. Like, I can mm-hmm. make this day matter. Like, mm-hmm. because I'm part of something greater that is hopeful. And I just feel like, and that's where the for those who are exploring Christianity, I'm like, are we a resurrection people or are we not? You know, regardless of where you land on the actual body, right? Are we a resurrection people? Mm-hmm. And if we're not, then that says a lot. But ultimately, mm-hmm. that's what we offer is hope. Mm-hmm.
My answer is very similar. And I'm not one of these people that thinks like there was some sort of pure early church that if we can just get back to
that.
then we'll be great. But what I will say is the thing that gives me hope about Christianity is that the very first people who experienced this story of Jesus, of his life, his death, his resurrection, the very first people who experienced his story, the first thing that they did in response to that was they started sharing everything together. That's the same story that the story that changed their lives and transformed their lives to share everything together. That is the same story we've got today. And I know that it is, that story can still transform each and every one of us, where maybe we start sharing everything in common and live a different way of, in the world.
I love it. I love it. And you've seen it happen, right? You can point to places where it's happened in modern day, right? And you can see where it's happening again, right? Mutual aid is, you know, the idea of, I mean, all these things that are coming out again or taking more of a forefront. I mean, I love it.
What are some practical recommendations you would suggest to people who are deconstructing or lifelong mainliners that just like don't really know exactly what they believe about Christianity? What would you suggest are maybe practical recommendations for them to really start getting at constructing their own theological beliefs? Besides obviously reading your book, what are other practical recommendations you have?
I think part of what I love about church is making people ask the question that everybody's asking, but nobody wants to ask. And so I think practicing that, I mean, I actually think preachers are going to read this secretly and be like, oh, okay, this might be good. But I encourage preachers in particular, ask the question you think everybody is asking in the room. Have the courage to do that right now. Ask the questions when we're recording this, right, what's happening in Gaza. Like, ask that question, and what does our faith have to say to that? Because that's what people are asking in the room. If it's about a theological concept, don't hide behind these kind of lovely words, but somewhere dive into, well, what does it mean for us to believe in this? So that would be for those kind of leadership people.
Can I just say something along those lines, too? One of the things that I remember hearing all the time kind of growing up was that whether it's youth or the oldest person in your congregation, they're only at church for the community or whatever. And I think that's obviously a big part for why people go to church. But to think that our congregants, whether they're a little child or the oldest person in the congregation, aren't thinking theologically about these things and have those questions, but just don't really know where to go to kind of flesh those ideas out, I think that just really does a disservice to those people. Because I remember when I was a youth pastor, I've got 13-year-olds who are, you know, experiencing their very first crush and their very first heartbreak in the world, getting their first zits, and they're also really curious, how should I think about sin, or how should I think about salvation? Those were exactly the same kind of questions that they were thinking about at the same time they were trying to figure out, you know, oh shit, did my algebra assignment is due right now? I got to do. So anyway,
exactly. No, I mean, I think one of the compliments I often get when after I preach or speak, like, you're so real. And I'm like, what does that say about every other person you've heard speak to you? Like, what is that? Because I think I don't know. You know, yes, congregations can sometimes be difficult and all those kind of things. But I actually think oftentimes we're scared because we may not know ourselves. And we've been conditioned to believe that we do have to give the, even in mainline churches where we pretend we don't need to have the answer, we do have conditioned ourselves that we're supposed to be able to give some kind of answer that's going to solve the anxiety that somebody holds about a particular thing. And I just think we have to practice more asking the question, figuring it out together, being communal about discernment, all that kind of stuff. So I think for those, that's a practical thing I would do. The thing I would say for anybody though, is to have these conversations with people who you trust to have these conversations with. And actually, you know, I was just on a call with somebody and we were talking about what you do when you're around a table. How would you start a conversation with your family if you haven't had the faith conversation before? And we're like, well, I'd say, you know, we hardly ever talk about God. What do you think about God? And to see where it goes, like, who knows? Because people are thinking about it. Like, what happens in the middle of your sermon or your middle of your worship? You decide we're going to just halt everything. And I want to know your first reaction when I say Jesus was raised from the dead, and just see what people say and be comfortable with all of this stuff. People, I just don't believe it happened. Well, I don't know. I mean, and just engage in how life-giving is that practice. And so the challenge for people is to engage in it, to ask the question, to be honest, to do it in a place that you trust. I think that's the other part, is to figure out a place where you can engage in these things in a space that you feel like you can actually engage. So I think there's a little bit of like figuring out, is this a safe place to do that? But mm-hmm. I just have always, the practical thing for me is actually ask the damn question that you want to get at. Mm-hmm. And I actually, the only good can come out of it. I just feel like only depth and texture can be added. So,
Well, I remember when I first started deconstructing, you know, obviously I had all these questions, but given the fact that conservative evangelicalism makes it seem like it's the only kind of Christianity out there, I didn't realize that there were other Christians out there that had the same exact questions.
Right.
And so when I started to encounter those Christians, I was like, great, I can actually start to either read how they think through these questions, maybe the written books, or maybe I can be in community and actually be in conversation with people about these questions. But it really changed my life when I realized the questions I was having are questions that other people have.
And across the theological spectrum, right? We're not even just in left or right or whatever. It's like, everybody's wondering what they think about resurrection, as we should. And let's keep talking about it, because it's okay to land in different spaces. And so what's the common thing? Like, what's the thing that then does kind of define this version or this stream or lane? Mm-hmm. So,
Keep talking. So the tagline of my podcast is Exploring, Inspiring, and Liberating Theology. So, Bruce, how do you hope this book inspires and liberates its readers?
Oh, my goodness. I hope it does give permission to normalize expansive theological thought. This is just how it is. There's no great leap you should have to make to think about this more expansively and to mm-hmm. think about multiple options. And one way is not the only way. And mm-hmm. for that to be normalized, I think that would do wonders for many of us and our institutions.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Last question. How can listeners get connected to you and your work, and where should they get the book?
Oh yeah. So you can buy the book and all the places that books are available. The bookshop is kind of where I go just in terms of being able to support local bookshops. There's also great bulk discounts from Broadleaf themselves. So you can get that at 6 or more, you start getting a pretty big discount. So, I did not realize that until now, but 6 or more, and it gets grows every time.
Well, if you're a pastor of a church,
yes.
Oh yeah. If you're a pastor of a church, I think you should use this as sort of like a church membership thing or whatever.
Telling you, I'm waiting for the first person to write Instant Classic, because actually confirmation, lay pastor training, all of those things, it is not, that's not what it was built for, but in some ways, as trying to kind of give the sweeping thing, totally. Yes, by lots. Anyway, I'm Reyes, B Reyes Chow on all the socials, and then Reyes-Chow.com. So people tell me sometimes I couldn't find you, and I'm like, okay, I'm the only Reyes-Chow in the world. You didn't look very hard. So I'm very easy to find for good or bad. But B. Reyes Chow, I'm mostly active on Instagram, is probably my main one. And I'm somewhat active on the other ones, but that's kind of where I do most of my stuff these days.
Well, it's nice to know you're also a fellow, the only person with your name in the world. I will say there is another Mason Menega in the world, but he is like not at all on the internet whatsoever. And so if there is a Mason Menega that you see on the internet, it's 100% me.
Is that you?
Well, Bruce, thank you so much for chatting about the book. I think it's awesome. I mean, truly, I think it's one of those books that really should be in a confirmation class or a church membership class or something. I really do think of it in that way. I think it's just so much more helpful than a lot of other things that, you know, I would imagine other people are using for confirmation and in church membership.
Well, so I appreciate
thank that. You so much for chatting more about it. I think it's going to be really helpful for a lot of people who, even those who are deconstructing. So thank you so much for writing it and chatting about it.
Great. Thanks for having me.
You can get connected with Bruce and his work in the links in the episode description. Thank you again for listening to another episode of A People's Theology. If you liked what you heard, please give the podcast a 5-star rating and review. Also, please support the podcast at my Patreon at patreon.com/Mason Menega. And remember, friends, go and be the theology to the world that inspires and liberates.